3:15. It is 3:15. We will reconvene. I only have one announcement for you. As I said earlier, the dinner tonight will be 7 p.m., but you can come into the room, have a glass of wine, whatever you wish, at 6:45. And the entree, which in this country is the appetizer, in the United States, the entree is the main meal, so it's some things are still interestingly confusing. The entree will be served at 7. All right, I will turn it over to Matthew Horspool, our code maintenance officer, and Clive Lansing, the Braille technology, no, something, we don't, technical guidelines. But it really isn't guideline, well, anyway. All right, go for it.
All right. Good afternoon. It's good to be back, I think. And it's thank you for electing me unopposed to be the official code maintenance officer for this term. I'm very grateful for that, and hopefully we'll have a good term. So, as code maintenance officer, I'm chair of the code maintenance committee. Clive... I'm at the front, I'm at the lectern. Clive is still at the sound desk for people that need to ask questions. Clive is the chair of the, I think we call it the UEB Technical Subcommittee, not to be confused with the Braille Technology Committee that James talked about earlier on. So this entire session is going to be about code, by which I don't mean computer code, I mean the UEB code itself. I mean the six dots and what they mean in various contexts, both literary and technical. I'd like to set some ground rules before we get started. The first one is that this is a discussion session, so there's not going to be any voting going on today. We're not passing resolutions, we're not doing anything like that. It's a discussion session, and I'm quite happy to hear from observers as well as delegates, so please don't be shy. If you've got something to say, then I'd love to hear it. The second thing, just to sort of counter that a little bit, this is purely an advisory session. Because we're not taking any votes today, I'm not saying that we're going to, you know, say something here and completely ignore it, but what I am saying is that it's advisory, and we may find that in the course of trying to carry out what we come up with this afternoon, you know, things might get in the way and other things may have to take precedence. So just sort of keep that in mind as we go through. We've got 90 minutes. So I really hope you've got lots to say. Otherwise, this is going to be a long 90 minutes. I think most people in the room will have something to say, so I'm not unduly worried, but, you know. There are a couple of things that I really want to talk about. Clive may have some other things that he wants to talk about. I'd quite like to talk about word lists. There's been an ongoing discussion for a long time about word lists and the fact that we need one that is more comprehensive than the one that we currently have. I think the need for such a word list is fairly well defined. We know that we need it. I'd quite like to get a feel for why we need it. You know, where do we draw the line in terms of what words we include? And also how we think we ought to package it. There's been a suggestion that perhaps it doesn't need to be in the rule book, perhaps it could be a supplementary document, a bit like, I suppose, the guidelines for technical material. So I'd be interested in some thoughts around that. The other thing that I would be interested in doing, there's a charge on the list for Clive, and that is to update the guidelines for technical material. That, I think, is going to be something of a focus over the next little while. One of the things that we need to consider is whether that guidelines for technical material update is going to be an update to the guidelines for technical material. Are we going to keep it as two separate publications, or are we going to incorporate it into the main rulebook and just have one publication? I really hope that Bill Jolly is still in the room, because I know that Bill has views on this, and I would be really interested to hear Bill's views on them, because I know he's been involved for a long time in this project. It would also be good to set some priorities or to talk about what priorities we perhaps ought to set for the forthcoming term, that being 2024 to 2028 and possibly beyond, but certainly set some priorities for that. Can I just take a quick straw poll? Is there anything else that anybody would particularly like to put on the agenda for this session? That's a dangerous question, I know, but you know, it would be good to hear that. Bowden, UK. That's mic 5. We don't know if your microphone is working. We might have a technical problem with it, but we'll try it. Perhaps in the interim, could we get a roving mic just so you can ask your question and then
the only one that is this one. Oh no, there's another one. That's true. Okay, here we go.
Victor Pecker, Pickle Pepper.
Yep.
The other thing, Matthew, I would say is, can we make any potential charges into charges? Can we review that list? There's a lot of potential charges which have been potential charges for a very long time, and they ought to make the light of day into at least charges.
Yeah, okay. I don't know if we're in a position to do that here. That feels more like business than discussion. But yes, certainly we can discuss. I think that would probably come under prioritisation, and I'm happy to do that, yes.
So, Matthew, could I just add that you're taking, I think, a quite a detailed view, and you'd have a lot more detailed knowledge of things to do with code than I have as an end user. My braille's probably a bit crappy, but but I know what I can read, and I recognise it when I read it. It might be a good time to just really check in with people to see how UEB is doing. It's about 20 years. And we had a vision, you know, when we started did all the work on UEB. We had a vision of what it might be and how it might perform. And, you know, it might be useful to just take a little time to see if it is actually meeting people's expectations. And if it isn't, what are the sort of, not in detail, but just those, what are the areas of poor performance that we need to be aware of, and perhaps related to that is, do we find that manufacturers are implementing UEB correctly and keeping their equipment up to date adequately? Because obviously, whatever decisions we make in, you know, forums like this one, but in any business type discussions, when we agree on doing something in a particular way, how long does it then take for that to actually get into the devices that people are using? And I suspect it might take quite some time. But and that might mean that people are judging UEB on, you know, its historic performance rather than on how it actually is performing.
Okay.
So that, you know, those are aspects we could discuss today. Is UEB meeting people's expectations? And if not, do we have any ideas on why that might be?
Okay. I think that would be a good place to start, actually, because if we talk about whether UEB is meeting people's expectations or not, then issues might come out of that, and that might give us an indication of what ought to be a high priority, because people are thinking about it and it's what's on people's minds. So, I mean, perhaps we ought to start there. Does anybody have any responses to that question or those comments from Clive?
This is Samuel Fuchs from Clovenook.
Sam Fuchs, hello. Thank
you. Hello. So from the manufacturer perspective, from a Braille production perspective, I can say that the work that ICEB is doing in terms of issuing its bulletins, we do very much take on board ahead of even, say, translator updates. So anytime there's guidance issued in terms of a short form or an adjustment to the code, we issue bulletins to all of our transcribers and proofreaders, and very much find the channels to be useful in terms of making sure that the Braille we produce is the latest and greatest. In terms of the kind of clientele that we serve, of course, everything that we produce now is in unified English Braille outside of the other languages that we produce. And I've only really heard from a handful of folks over the last 8 years who seem to be rather, you know, set in their ways when it comes to wanting EBAE, but with very rare exceptions, we no longer produce an EBAE, and everyone seems to be quite happy from a reader perspective. So just thought I'd share.
Yeah. If you've still got the mic, Sam, you as a transcriber or manager of transcribers, do you have a sense of how transcribers are finding it? Are they finding it easier to transcribe UEB than EBAE or harder or about the same? Do you have any sense of that?
I don't think there's much difference. I'll say that Duxbury and the various ways you can use it have come a long way in the last 8 years. So I do think that transcribing as a whole has gotten easier, and some of the things you can do with Word and various ways you can import documents. I think transcribing as a whole has gotten easier. And from a production standpoint, my first ICEB back in 2016, I think I gave a presentation on how at Klovenik we adjusted all of our processes, and it was a kind of like the Y2K bug in that there was lots of oh, this is going to be so terrible, it's going to be really hard, and it really wasn't too tricky to pull off, and I think that also Duxbury and other market forces, I think, were very proactive in making sure that all the tools were there. So from a Braille production standpoint, it's all gone quite swimmingly the last 8 years.
That's good. Thank you.
So an example of, just one example that comes to mind of the sort of thing that might be bothering people out there. I was talking to a person this morning here, and he commented that, there are devices and software that support UEB, but in a particular mode or at a particular point where you might enter an email address, you have to switch to computer Braille. In other words, the UEB isn't implemented fundamentally. It's implemented in certain parts of the product, but not universally. And yet UEB is capable of completely representing just about anything that we know about, and it's our vision that it should be able to represent everything we know about. Now, I use a bit of software on my iPhone called mBraille, and its UEB implementation is also a bit flaky in places, and we rely, I guess, on manufacturers to get this right. And there's maybe not a lot that we can do if it's not right, or just wait for the next release or something like that. But still, the reality is that today's an opportunity to discuss or to just comment on just how effective people are finding UEB in the, in the day-to-day reality we all face. So, like I said, if I'm using something like mBraille, in order to get my job done, to get the task done, whatever I happen to be doing, I might sometimes have to switch contractions off and enter something in grade one simply because it isn't back translating properly like it should. If it was genuinely true UEB, it should be possible to enter whatever I need without having to do that. So I think some of us are jumping through hoops to make things work, and we who are close to the technology, I guess, understand that is something we might have to do. Other people might just view it as yet another limitation of UEB and what was all the fuss about. And in other words, that maybe they might perceive UEB as not as successful as it could have been, simply because their experience of it is influenced by how it has been implemented. So that's just a thought of mine. I personally think UEB has lived up to its expectations. That's because I know how it should work and I know what it can do if it's implemented properly. But like I said, I do find instances, and I think the person I was talking to this morning was also of the same view, that there are instances where it just hasn't been implemented properly. And then you have to basically turn it off and say, well, in order to enter this, I have to actually turn it off and go to computer braille, which, of course, some people would not know how to do. So that's just a thought of mine to keep us going.
Yeah, thank you. Dunham, United States, hello. Yes.
Hello. Just to second very strongly what Clive is saying, and I'm going to talk a little more about this tomorrow in my presentation as well, but the it's clear based on, you know, when you look at different software and do sort of comparisons, Unified English Braille absolutely was carefully designed to make sure that it could be backward or translated to print and to Braille, and the implementation it causes me a lot of concern too. I hear a lot of, Braille is just unreliable when you do it in contracted form, and that's not what's happening. That's about the implementation, and I think it's especially true in the Braille to print arena. I also want to add about typeform indication. That was an area that I felt was going to surely get better as because of the way it's been designed. It's designed more clearly to delineate starts and stops on that. The implementation of being able to read in Braille with actual Braille UEB indicators, those typeforms, is very, very hit or miss, mostly miss. One screen reader does it pretty consistently, but others either don't do it at all or do it only in limited situations.
Bowden, UK.
I'll try your mic, but I'm not sure if it works. Otherwise, get a roving mic. No, it doesn't work. Okay, this one. Right.
Just on that typeform thing, part of the problem there is the typeforms is not the text, it's the text attributes. And the screen readers that you're particularly probably mentioning generally only send the text through the translator, not the attributes as well. That would be easy to fix in some cases, but if the screen reader does not actually fetch those text attributes, then that will be something further for the screen reader to do. It's, again, the screen reader that's at fault, not UEB.
Oh, absolutely, I agree. Yep. And I think that's what we're saying here, James, that we know what UEB can do. It's up to implementers to really see the point of implementing it properly and taking care of those extra details, which perhaps they've just skipped over in their implementations.
Golden Four, Canada, hello. Yeah.
Just to kind of add into that, the one thing, though, is that a lot of, and I don't know about all screen readers, but a couple in particular, you can get them to tell you the attributes. So if you can get them to tell you the attributes, it's the screen reader obviously is getting that information. I don't know whether it's getting it in the way it needs to for the Braille display, but you can get speech output. So I feel like,
absolutely,
they can just go the whole rest of the way and make it work properly. Yeah, and it. I mean, I know I'm kind of preaching to the choir. We all think that it should, but it seems like it's so close, they could just go the rest of the way.
Yeah.
Is me? Ivan from Spain?
Hello, Ivan, hello.
Hello. one of my concerns on the upgrading of operating systems is that sometimes some devices are left behind. So, or maybe in the upgrade won't get there, and I would suggest that they would take into consideration just to upgrade this, the screen reader system and the Braille system Likewise, for example, it happens with the security upgrade. Sometimes the devices won't be upgraded to the next operative system. However, they could take into account, okay, doesn't matter, we won't upgrade your device, it's very old, that's okay. However, we would give support to the next fixing that we can make to the screen reader software. Actually, that I heard, for example, in Android, you can upgrade separately the screen reader software as such, the TalkBack, for example, or previous BrailleBack, but not in iOS. In iOS, you are upgrading the whole thing at once. So if you have an old phone and you have a system, iOS 12, you cannot go further either. It was only a mistake. And sometimes it happens that you cannot see transparently what changes have been implemented, what were the improvements, and what that have been achieved. That I would like to hear of what were the contractions, what were the omissions, and things like that. Thank you.
Thank you. Scott first, and then Bill. Mike six.
Yep.
Moving down. Hello. This is really interesting discussion, and one of the things I wanted to say was that there are certain devices and certain combinations of screen readers where unless you have a certain firmware on a particular device at a certain date, you can't get those amazing new sort of implementations of UEB or whatever they've put in. And it really must confuse, I mean, it confuses a lot of us, but it must really confuse, you know, particular students who are trying to learn the code and they've got, say, well, without sending them out, you know, say an iPad and a Braille display. We won't name any manufacturers here. But, it must be confusing because it's like, well, why aren't I seeing it yet? Somebody else who's using the same combination is seeing it. And so I think it is something, we know it can all happen, but I guess it's more of a something we all need to push for better, you know, better access.
Thank you. Bill Jolly on probably roving one.
Thank you. So now we've had UEB for 20 years. It's timely perhaps to look back at what were the, and I meant to bring the list with me so I could go through it. What were the list of sort of objectives of the UEB? And they were things like computability and a single harmonised code, etc. Have we met those objectives? Does this code meet those objectives? And I think broadly that it does. There seem to me some areas where we still need to do some further work, and perhaps one of the elephants in the room or snakes in the grass or whatever you want to think about is contractions. And I remember the discussion about contractions in 2004 where it was looking like we were just never going to make a decision. And so then we made a fairly kind of blunt decision, which was to, in essence, but this wasn't quite the wording, to follow the British rules with certain exceptions. It wasn't written that way because of transatlantic sensitivities. It was to follow a certain set of rules with certain objectives, but it was certain exceptions. But I don't know that we've really tidied that up or in fact resolved some of the issues that Robert Engelbretson has raised with contractions. So I suspect that it's a tough area, but there is a bit more work there to perhaps remove some contractions that are a bit ugly as they go right across syllable boundaries. The I'll talk about emoticons. So I don't think I really knew what emoticons were 20 years ago, and I still don't know much about them, but I notice, and I don't know, in fact, how UEB really deals with emoticons, rather than maybe to have some sign and a transcriber's note. But I don't think that that's... But my real point here is I don't think that that's, that works for emoticons. If you look at the iPhone, there's, oh, I don't know, is it 20, 40, 50, 748 emoticons? I'm not sure. There's heaps of them. And there will be more and more smiling, face with smiling eyes, beer glasses clinking, party hat with poppers or whatever they are. And so we need to think about how we treat these. As an associated thing, back when I was wore a younger kid's clothes, and for the same for the some of us, the braille we had was perhaps what we wrote on our slate and stylus, or what we wrote with our Perkins, or what we got from the transcriber. They were the books that we read, either at school or in the library. But now, things are very different. And more, for more of us, Braille is what we get every day, intermediated by our screen reader or coming off our iPhone. And there's no transcriber within a bull's roar of the place. So when we think about, say, emoticons, if we're going to have a system of dealing with them, it has to be a system other than with transcriber's notes. I don't know what it is, but I think that it is one. If it's not already on our charge list, it needs to go there. I'll leave it at that at this stage.
Thank you, Bill. I really appreciate that. So there were two things that you said. One of them was emoticons, and the other one has just completely gone out of my head, but it'll contract. Bridging contractions, yes. So the bridging contractions point, I ought to give an update on that really to see where we're at with that. So the bridging contractions point is a good one, and thank you for raising it. I have a piece of work to do to synthesize the thoughts that the Code Maintenance Committee have already come up with and to try and put some strategy together. And once some strategy has been put together, we'll make some rules on that. So that is in hand, but I appreciate you bringing it up because it's good to know it's good to know that people think it's an issue, and it's at the risk of being a little undiplomatic, it's good to know that other countries outside the countries that previously used EBAE find it an issue, because that's good to know. The issue of emoticons, emojis, I suppose. Thanks for raising that. This has been an interest of mine for a while, but I've not wanted to express a bias in terms of bringing it forward, so I'm glad that you have. I'd be interested to take a sense of the room as to whether anybody has any particular strong views. I've been thinking about this a lot and have some thoughts, and I'm happy to sort of put them in writing. But has anybody else really spent any time thinking about how we could possibly represent emojis in Braille? And would there be anybody else who'd be interested in working on a subgroup's worth of work? Would there be anybody interested in working on that as a project?
Yes.
Okay.
I have a student who would love you.
I didn't catch who said what. So we had Bowden, we had Golden, Dunham. Sorry?
Fine. Yeah.
Can we go to Golden first, and then we'll go to Dunham? Thank you.
All right. I just have to get my thank you. I just wanted to say, yes, I do think it's something we need to look into. While I find sometimes the transcriber's notes in on the iPhone entertaining, and they are. Sometimes they really are, if you know what I'm talking about. I think that they are really, really, they can get very lengthy, I think that's, I mean, it's very cool that, you know, the transcriber's note symbols come up and there's this description, and sometimes you compare it with what the sighted person meant and they're like, oh, I didn't realize it was telling you that. So there can be a little bit of discrepancy, I guess, but yeah, I think my main sort of, while I find it fun, is just, you know, especially if you have a display with, like, I don't know, 20 cells or something like that, right? Six of those are transcriber's notes. And you could have, I have actually seen emoji descriptions that are like three display lengths, like they can get really wordy. So,
Then there are three of them in a row.
And then, yes, yes, exactly. So.
Matthew, I'll just comment that.
That's a good point. Could we go to Jennifer Dunham next and then come back to you, Clive? Sorry.
Okay, yeah, that's cool. Yep.
Sure. Is this thing on? Coming through. Yes. So I'm curious with people's comments about transcribers' notes versus the indicators that are being talked about. My one thing I think about sometimes is, should we rename those indicators? Because they're going to be needed at other times. And what they really mean is, these words are not in print. These words are value added for Braille purposes. So I wonder if consideration of renaming those would be a help. The second part, though, is just a clarification about the content that shows up when you have an emoticon or emoji. Those are defined names for the emoji. When the emoji are developed, they get words that are specific to them, and they are, that's what they're called. So that's another thing to be considered. But yes, I think we need a lot more discussion, and I'm happy to help with doing it.
Thank you. What were you trying to redefine? Sorry, I didn't quite catch what you meant.
The indicators. I was curious if people, it seemed as though there was a lot of opposition or concern with using the transcriber's notes indicators to surround the names of the emoji. And if that's the case, I wonder if it's about it being a transcriber note, and what if we consider a different name for those indicators?
Oh, okay. Yes, okay. Thank you. Can I take Lansing first?
I was just going to make the comment that, first of all, the question is this important? And I think the answer is yes, it is. And particularly, I think, for younger people. I mean, I know Bill Jolly did comment that he doesn't have a lot of interest in emoticons, or doesn't know much about them, or whatever he did say, but I resonated with that. But I do know people not using Braille, but using keyboards and other input mechanisms. Younger people, when they're writing text messages and other sort of quick pieces of communication, are picking from at least a library of familiar emoticons that they want to use. And I suspect that what would happen is, even if we could theoretically assign a code, a dot sequence to every one, even if it was just a formula, but people would remember the ones they wanted to use most frequently, and they would probably, I guess some people would remember, I don't know, 20 emojis to use in their messages, you know, crying face, laughing face, you know, whatever it might be. And I think some people, particularly if you could then input that, so in other words, it's one thing to have a description, but in order to input it, you need a genuinely assigned character sequence, a Braille dot sequence, if you like, that generates this Unicode character, because I think in the end that's what they are. So there's an official list of them, and they exist in their own right as characters. So there's no reason why UEB can't deal with that, and people would remember the ones they want to remember or what you use, and the ones they don't use, that the ones they don't recognize, I suspect in time to come, just as, like, if you use a screen reader like JAWS or NVDA, you could sit on a character and I ask the screen reader to identify it, and what it can then do is tell you all about that character, its full description, its Unicode value, things like that. So if you're in a Braille context, there's no reason why when you've now got this strange symbol under your finger that you can't, that your Braille device can't tell you what the image what it actually is. So then you might say, oh, that's cool, I wouldn't mind using that image, you know, later in my messages, and just learn the ones that you want. So I certainly think this can be done, and I do think there'd be a level of interest in it, particularly from younger people who want to join the brigade of people who want to express themselves in this particular way.
Thank you, Clive. James Bowden?
Yeah, you'll have to use a roving mic for James.
Should I just move to a different table?
That's right.
Serious. A couple of points here. So, absolutely agree with you there, Clive. It's definitely possible. There are, I think, two definite distinct approaches. One is the transcriber note, and the other is the custom shape symbol, .4ED sign, or .4.1246, which is what some Braille translators already use, e.g. Duxbury, for signs it doesn't know what they are. It will do .4ED and then a U plus, which is the Unicode value. There is a proposal already given, and I don't like to put Canada on the spot. There was the Canadian Cooperative suggested how to do emoticons and emojis several years ago. I don't know where that spec is at. And I absolutely agree, if we actually define how these things work, then you could build it into screen readers, how to back translate, forward translate, etc., etc. The advantage of transcriber notes is you could use contractions as normal. The disadvantage is it's 6 cells extra work, which, as we say, makes them very long. The advantage of your .4ED is it's a shorter indicator, and it could be as few as 2 extra cells if it's a single word. Snowflake, parcel, wine glass. The disadvantage is you have to use uncontracted Braille.
Why? Because of the shape. Yeah. I mean, a third, for the benefit of the minutes, I think it was the Commonwealth Braille and Talking Book Library or something like that. And if we look back far enough in the archives, there is a link to it. It was a very primitive proposal, and I remember not liking it much at the time. But I can't say that as the chair, because the chair doesn't have an opinion. A third option, which I've thought about, would in fact be to invent an entirely new mode. We have arrow mode, we have shape mode, we have numeric mode. Why not have emoji mode? And then within emoji mode, then you have scope to reassign whatever symbols you want to mean whatever you want. And that, I think, would be where my mind would go.
I tend to feel the same, Matthew, and I think we'd have to do some experiments or see what it might look like if we went down that track. So there's obviously work to do, and what we might be discussing today is whether this work is important enough to be slotted into the list of work that's in front of us.
Thank you.
And it sounds like there's a sentiment suggesting that it is something that needs to be given some attention.
I heard Paul Brown.
And me.
I'll make one, thanks. I'm not a young person, Clive. Happy to admit that. I'm not as young as I was, but I guess the issue is what I want to be able to do is to understand and know what people are putting. So I don't think this is just a young person's issue about using them. For me, the big issue is, what the hell are they saying? I want to know whether they've liked my post, whether they dislike it, whether they're angry or sad, or whether they think I've made a total dick of myself, or whatever, right? So I think we do need to know these. The other thing is that where young people are involved, we are already behind the times. One of our observers here from New Zealand, Amanda Goff, who's a teacher at Blends, has a student who's done a whole bloody lot of these. He's come up with his own code and his own symbols, and he's doing them. And if you want, you know, if you want to talk to him, Amanda's more than happy to make that connection. There are people. If we don't do this, people will do it themselves, and we'll end up in a bit of a mess. Mm. And so people are doing it, and we should probably... I agree the starting point is talking to young people, probably, but I think us oldies need to know what these things mean, because they are really telling about what people think about a Facebook post, for example.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No, that's a fair point. And my point was simply that you also... want to be able to use them, that's where it's important to be able to enter it in a
as a
set of characters that will genuinely back translate to the image.
No, I get that. We've got to do both though. We've got to be able to read other people's.
Yes, absolutely.
Quite often, you know, with Facebook or something, you'll just get an emoji to your post.
Yes.
Nobody will say a word.
And you can't tell where that's going.
But there is a student, and we can put you in touch with the student who has come up with how many, Amanda? A whole heap of them.
Ten.
Oh, he was told to limit it to 10, and he did what his teacher said. So that means he probably has about 30, and 20 he's not told her about.
Sure. I heard somebody else with a comment. I didn't catch who it was.
Yes, I have a question.
Yes, who are you, sorry?
I'm Tino.
Ah, thank you.
Hi, well, thanks for the very interesting discussion. In my status as an observer, I apologize in advance if some of the comments that I will make, you know, make no sense to anybody, because I feel like I'm, you know, most of the times, ever since I entered this conference, I feel like I have a lot to catch up on. Generally, my comments relate to the... you know, to both the code and the contractions. I think in terms of the code, I am just wondering, and this is out of curiosity, what was the rationale for us to, you know, for whoever who decided to change this code, to have it changed so it looks like more looking like a print version of documents? Because, you know, like when I started reading some of the Braille documents, there is a lot of things, and my concern is, you know, we are changing these things now, and how are we relating it back to, you know, to the ordinary, you know, to the people on the ground? Like, how are we communicating this to students in schools? How are we communicating things like the contractions and for of the width in which it used to be connected together, now they're separating with the UEB code? How are these things then get translated to the children of tomorrow? Is my, because we are already, if I'm already trying to catch up now, then imagine our young ones who have been taught Braille using the other, and now, you know, with us introducing them to the UAB. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, just a thought.
Thank you. I appreciate the thought. I don't want to have too much of a protracted conversation about the history of UEB here. It's a long conversation, and I would advise have a chat with someone like Bill Jolly over dinner, and he'll fill you in on a lot of that history. But in brief, it had to do with various things. The rationale nowadays would be that there's a lot more back translation that's needed. You know, if you're using an electronic note taker or something and you need to get that Braille back into print reliably, you need a code that can do that. And that is nowadays, I think, what I would say would be the predominant reason to go with UEB. There were lots of other reasons as well to do with unifying codes across countries and unifying codes across subjects and all sorts of things. But that's I think, what my answer to that question would be.
But can I add to that, without going back over history, what we've learned in the last 20 years, though, is certainly every effort was made to design UEB to be as close as it could be to the older English Braille American edition or whatever version of Braille that you might have been using. But and so for those people who knew that Braille, they did have to make a transition, and some people still today are resistant to that transition. But what we've also learned in the last 20 years is that those younger people starting out who never knew anything else, so they have been learning UEB from the ground up, and they're fine. So, you know, so the problem we're discussing, if there is a problem at all, is a transitionary one. It's not one that's embedded in UEB totally. We actually know that UEB is actually working as expected, because the next generation of Braille readers who are learning it are finding it logical. And they can extend their knowledge to include mathematics, which is, of course, the subject of my subcommittee, and other technical subjects, of course. So I think, you know, we know that it has created a problem, the transition. We wanted it to be as minimal as possible, but it was going to be some change. That has impacted on some people, but we also know that the next generations coming through are picking up UEB, and teachers are saying that it's easier to teach, easier to learn, just with a more logical set of rules. So I think in that sense, if we look forward, we can see a future for UEB that would have been under threat if we hadn't made those changes, because of the technology and because the blind people and increasingly having to be aware of the sighted world we live in, and students in particular having to do work in a way that is visually presentable, which means they did have to have some understanding of print formatting and what it means to have headings and what it means to have indented lists and things like that, which perhaps in the older days of Braille we weren't too concerned about, right? Even other details that we could just skip over in older Braille, but which wouldn't be acceptable now. So I think we have to count UEB as a success in that respect, and although it might be hard still for some people with that transition, we can be positive about the next readers coming through.
Thank you, Clive. Yes, DeAndrea for the minutes.
Excuse me, I'm so sorry. I am typing away madly over here. But I know you, Matthew asked who might be interested in working with him on just discussing the emoji issue. And I heard Jennifer Dunham and Jen Golden, and I heard at two people over on the other side of the room, but I did not know who they were. And if you want me to let Matthew know, tell me who you are so I can put this in the minutes. All right, Amanda.
James and Amanda.
James and Amanda, right.
And Chantel.
Thank you.
Remind me your last name, Chantel. You've only... Griffiths, of course. You've only presented 5,000 times. Okay, thank you. I have it for the minute.
Thank you. Yes, so I'm hearing James and I'm hearing Jody.
Not to join it, but to make a comment.
Okay, fine. I'll take James first because I heard him first, then I'll take Jody. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Just to say, regarding the transition from an older Braille code to a newer Braille code, there are documents around detailing what the changes are and sometimes why the changes are. Now, I know in UCAF we have some of these, in RNIB we have some of these, and I've written some of them as well. If you want some of those documents, please see me and I'll be very happy to share them with you.
Thank you, James. Jody?
Hi. I was... interested when I heard the term emoticon. I was like, you don't hear that these days. So I looked it up just quickly and I thought that might be useful for nomenclature. Emoticon is a sequence of keyboard characters used to illustrate a facial expression. Remember when we used to do like the semicolon, the bracket? Yeah, but that seems to be kind of... Yeah, but less so. So emoji is defined as a small image used in place of text. So all the kind of graphic things. And I'm with Paul, like sometimes you don't know. I'm sighted, but I still don't always know what all these emojis are. You know, like, they're coming up with new ones, and I can't zoom in and see what they are, and I try to hover and find these words so I know what they are. So that would be useful. And I agree with Clive as well that, you know, I think it would be useful to have, like, a number that you know and you use, and because, I mean, how many can we all know? Then after a breakfast conversation with James and Jennifer, they were on this topic, I kind of went to my GTM and I was like, I didn't understand about the grade one requirement in shape mode, and I couldn't sort of find that. And I asked Josie, and we're looking at an example in the, you know, the GTM, where they talk about these emojis and how you can represent them, you know, either using the dot for ED, like a couple of words, or use brackets around. Sorry, I'm not making much sense. I'm just having a look at it. They have got an example here where they've got dot for ED, and then they've got grouping brackets, the Braille grouping indicator, and then they've got smiling in grade one, face, and then closing the Braille grouping indicator. And we didn't know why there was no grade one indicator for the Braille indicators, and why the smiling was uncontracted, and it got us thinking. And then I was also kind of excited by what Matthew was suggesting, you know, having an emoji mode, and I quickly looked and I thought, oh, damn, 4-5-ED, it's already taken, you know, because that would be a nice one, you know, with dot 4-ED is the, what's that one? That's the shape, you know, when the 4-5-6 is a filled shape indicator. Sorry, the ED is just the shape indicator. The dot 4 is when it's a transcriber assigned shape indicator. I'm not up on all these. And then you've got a shaded one, it's dot 4-6. So it's a shame that, you know, 4-5-ED isn't available. Apparently it's a ring circle above following letter. So damn. It's interesting. Watch this space. Yeah, so maybe someone in the room could answer about, you know, the setting of grade one mode by shapes. You know, I always thought that, you know, if you're using the shape indicator in a grade two context, you need to put the grade one indicator so it's not read as ED.
Yeah. I'll take golden first. I heard goth afterwards. Thank you.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm just going to move that. Apple's sitting here. Sorry. If someone else wants to explain this, I'm totally happy for that. But if you were using grade two, if you're using contracted Braille, that ED could be an ED, right? So the dot four ED, it does set grade one mode, and the grouping is because the space, if you have smiling face, the space would terminate the shape, right? So,
you know, with the, so why does that set grade one mode?
So dot, dot four ED. I need to look at the rules, and perhaps there is a piece of work. Perhaps that's something we need to look at, is to review those rules and possibly clarify them if we think they need clarifying.
Yeah, I'm not up on certainly. Shape.
I know it sets grade one mode, but I just can't remember where
why?
The.
Why? Yeah.
My understanding is that the shape indicators set grade one. So you don't need. You don't need a grade one indicator for the dot four, because dot four is a prefix and therefore changes the meaning of the ED sign that follows it.
Yeah, yeah. But you need a grade one indicator before the ED if you're just in normal shape mode, like, for example, if you're doing a triangle.
Do. Yes, because that then becomes the prefix. But if you've got a dot four ED, would be a defined sign in its own right and therefore wouldn't.
Yes.
Wouldn't need a grade one.
So, but does that set grade one? I couldn't.
So I think I don't know, and I need to look at the rules around that. And I think that would be it. Okay. I'd quite like to. I'll take. Amanda Goff wanted a comment, and I know that James does. And I'd quite at that point quite like to move on, because it's getting a little bit detailed.
You don't say.
Amanda here. I just want to keep this brief, but and I haven't got I fully, guilty as charged, do not have the entire grade 2 code in my head. But I believe that my student has a system where he uses, I think it's not 4-6, it might be 5-6, followed by a low, I think it's 4-6 actually, followed by a lower letter symbol. And he's got 10 of them, obviously, with A through J, and each of those represents one of the 10 most commonly used emoticons. So all he does is has a space around it and has 4-6, say, low D might be smiley face, 4-6, low F might be frown, 4-6, H is heart, I know that.
Okay. Thank you. James?
Thank you. The reason is there are other signs in shape mode which have normal contracted meanings. I'm thinking of the things like the enclosure indicator, the horizontal and vertical juxtaposition indicators, which have incredibly long names, but you could theoretically build more complex shapes with these signs. Whether you should do that with a custom shape indicator is a different discussion, but it is doable currently. So that's probably the reason why contractions are not allowed in shape mode. Think of a circle enclosing a plus sign, for example.
Matthew, I just can't help commenting here that if you go back to my report, and I talked about it being a learning experience, when you come into these discussions and you're up with people like James Bowden, and there's others as well. Jody is, you know, from Australia, and there's plenty of others. They have just a phenomenal knowledge of Braille that probably most of us will never will never even read, let alone understand. Mm-hmm. But that's where these discussions end up in these, at the sharp end of the thinking in subcommittees. That's exactly what happens, because you think, oh, this would be a good idea. And then you 5 minutes with James and you realise that, no, hang on a second, there's a lot more to be thought of than what I had in mind. So that's what this is about, and I think I understand what Matthew means by we could be getting into too much detail here. We might have to pull out of this and just think about other things before our time is up.
Thank you. I realise it's not what I put on the agenda, but I did want to return to the comment from Sam Moore, because I think it's interesting, and it raises an interesting point that I'd quite like some thought in the room on. We've just published, we're just about to publish the third edition of the rule book, and I commented in my report that finding all of the changes that we'd made was more scattered than it perhaps ought to have been, and that we'd made efforts in the past to try and sort that out, and they were sort of successful, but perhaps could have been more successful. And it's a good point. Yes, I mean the transition from SEB to UEB was fair enough. That was fairly well documented. All of these minor rule changes, perhaps not so much, or perhaps not so obviously, and I'd quite like to get an opinion as to how the room feels we ought to handle this going forwards. What we've done up until now is the Code Maintenance Committee has approved a rule, has recommended that a rule be approved. We've gone to the executive. The executive has said yes or no, but largely yes. It's gone up on the website. We've kind of had a news brief about it, and a press release that people may or may not have read, and then we've all kind of moved on. The thought was a while ago that we would publish periodically an addendum to the rules of Unified English Braille that would have all the changes in. Do people think that that's a good way to go, or in fact would it be more useful from the point of view of communicating changes if we had a schedule, if we said we'll collect all of these changes and then once a year we'll publish an update and maybe then run a workshop once a year to say here are all of the changes that we've made this year and here are how you implement them? I'd just be interested in some comments on that. Golden, thank you.
I
I like the idea of having a workshop maybe once a year to kind of, and then if people want to sign up for that, it's easy enough to do that kind of thing on Zoom. I also like that we publish, like I would hate for us to make a decision in February that we wouldn't make available to people. And, you know, like, let's say, okay, I'm just randomly, like, let's say January 4th is when ICEB releases, you know, updates. And we, Code Maintenance Committee makes a decision, or the executive votes on it in February, and then we don't make it available for months. So I like the approach where we put things up on the web and do, you know, kind of an announcement. So I think a combination of those things, and then making sure that all the updates we do are in a document somewhere, so that if ever somebody wants to look at them, they don't have to go on the website and like kind of collate and paste it all into a Word file. So I think a mix would be good.
Hmm. And how often do we publish that document? Do we publish that document literally every time a rule is changed?
I haven't thought. No, I was thinking of it more for us keeping a record than actually publishing the document. But I'm not opposed to publishing the document. I just hadn't. As you can tell, I sort of thought and then spoke not very long after I thought.
No, that's all right. That's fine. I was just curious to know what your thought process was.
The document was more for keeping track of it. Like, because now that we're getting to the third edition, right, it's like, well, what are all the updates? Oh, well, go on the website and you'll see all the updates.
Find them, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to avoid, yeah.
Yeah, so just at least having a document somewhere that we at least have, and if somebody wanted to see it, I don't know. I'm just talking. I'm just making stuff up now, so I should probably stop before you all fire me.
Did I hear James? No? Okay. Does anybody else have any thoughts on that? Hazelton, yeah.
Thank you very much. Agree. And I also agreed on your suggestion, Matthew, of how we can do an audio something, because some of these changes for us, we really need to understand the depth, and we really need to understand how we can apply it to our setting. So that can be combined into the workshop or whatever hybrid method that we're going to use. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ari. Okay, we have half an hour left. We actually have slightly less. We have 28 minutes left. There's a couple of other things I wanted to touch on sort of as we start to wrap this up. I would quite like a steer from the room, less so on Appendix 2. We can take that offline if we need to, but I would quite like a steer from the room about the guidelines for technical material and the rules of unified English Braille, and whether people think that that really, you know, if we update GTM, ought we to incorporate that into the rulebook, or should we keep them separate? I think Bill Jolly, without wanting to put you on the spot, did you want to make some comments to that effect yesterday but didn't get a chance?
Well, recognising the frustration perhaps to the chair yesterday, I essentially made the comments then, forgetting that there was this session today. But I'll just briefly say again what I said. I think that we've been a bit caught up trying to codify the way we treat mathematics as tightly defined rules, rather than being a bit more relaxed and flexible and thinking in terms of guidelines set against the background of the rules. Guidelines to help transcribers in writing maths, and also that Braille readers can pick up, either proofreaders or math students can pick up to learn how math is treated in UEB. I didn't really have any textbooks in mathematics when I was at school and then university studying maths, but one book that I had that I found, well, in fact, I did have one textbook which we got from RNIB I think it was G.W. Quandt, An Introduction to Infinitesimal Calculus, published in about 1934. It was a fantastic book, and R&OB should be very proud that they did that book then. And it was my Bible in year 11 and 12 and first couple of years at uni learning calculus. But I also had the Braille notation booklet that R&IB published that had a lot of examples at the back of and it had a number of proofs and just set it out how to do it. And I learnt a huge amount from that. I think we've got bogged down. We've been working 8 years on revising the guidelines. And I was the first one to do that work, and for various reasons I wasn't able to continue in the lead. But it wasn't envisaged that it would take eight, and at the rate we're going, probably significantly longer to do it. And so I wonder if the kind of the original intent has got a bit lost, and things got a bit blurred by the view from some that the guidelines, which was a book written by Janet Reynolds here in New Zealand, and it was a fantastic effort at the time, but people said, well, we need to have more examples. Well, given that it was the first thing that had examples, that's not really should not be interpreted as a criticism of that, but an expression of the deep felt need for more examples. But I think it's better to have, and more readable to have, the examples in a guidelines format than in a rule book format. And so I think it's probably, it's raining extremely heavily here. I'm Hail, I'm glad the roof is in good condition. So I think that this relates to perhaps it's okay for there to be several ways to write something. I'm not fixated about whether we've got to use a passage indicator or a word indicator, and I sort of feel there shouldn't, it's just an example of, there shouldn't be just one way and only one way to write things. There can be preferred ways. And the important thing is, as long as back translation works for whatever way something's written, then that should be good enough. And the back translation is very important for kids at school. And we mustn't overlook that. But, of course, something that's a new thing didn't exist 30 years ago, 40 years ago, but it does now, and it's very prominent, so we've got to give it very high priority. But we've also got to have a code written in a way that a student doesn't have to go back and sort of check their work to see if they've got the letter signs in the right place. They should be able to write intuitively, thinking about the content, and the code support them in that. Because their objective is to get the mathematics right, and the code is secondarily, rather than to write the correct code and hope they learn the maths in the process. So I'll leave those thoughts there, and very happy to hear other people's views.
Yes. Matthew.
Clive, thank you.
Clive here. I agree with Bill that we are talking about guidelines rather than rules here, and like recommended ways to handle specific kinds of work, and so it's not an, I guess it's not an error if you choose not to take up that recommendation, because UEB will still be readable, and if a student enters their UEB into a machine that's back translating, it should back translate correctly, whether you use a grade one symbol or a word or a passage, as long as the person doing the writing, the student in this case, you know, has got it right. I think I haven't got the text in front of me, but the UCAF, you know, the the draft that they came up with, which then the subcommittee did some modifying on, I think in that passage, in that text, there is a comment about specifically to do with students that, that just to make it clear that it isn't. I could be wrong, and James or someone could correct me, that it isn't an error to not do it, because you might be writing an exam and you've started to already write the answer, and then you think, hang on a second, I've now gone over 2 grade 1 indicators, I should have done a passage instead. Obviously we don't want students to to have to worry about that sort of thing, and as long as what they're writing is clear, then it's still right. But it's more directed at Braille producers. When they're producing work, this is a set of recommendations that we're asking Braille producers to follow, because although Bill is right about there should be different ways to do things, when I say that's his view, the other view has been said that the problem is with UEB that there's too many ways to do things, certain things. Now, it's not a view I subscribe to, but as I explained in my speech yesterday, but it is a view. And so if the call is for people to be more consistent in the production of UEB, then those recommendations are there for that purpose, and we hope that Braille producers, if we ultimately vote formally to update the guidelines accordingly, then the request is that Braille producers take those recommendations on board. So I think hopefully Bill it is right, but the question of whether or not it should be part of the rule book, I think I'm with you. I think it's more a case of just keeping them as a separate document that people can read when they're doing technical materials that will help them to ensure that their work is consistent with what other producers are doing.
Thank you, Clive. Judy Dixon wishes to have the microphone. How dare I refuse?
Which one is she getting? The roving one? Yeah.
Did somebody ask for it before, Judy?
DeAndrea.
Yeah. DeAndrea, okay. Okay, we'll take DeAndrea, and then we'll take Judy, and then we'll take Leona. Thank you. Okay.
Judy's already got a mic. Do you want me to talk? All right, I'll talk. Okay. 2 things. The rule book should have rules in it. That sounds stupid. But the I think because our various countries have always have traditionally had separate math codes, whether it was British maths or Nemeth or South African systems, whatever it was, I think the mental effort for people to understand that UEB is a complete and comprehensive code, we need to reinforce that by having all the rules in one rule book. And otherwise, we're going to continue talking about UEB math as if it's a separate code. But having the guidelines for technical materials as a supplement to the rule book is an approach. I know in BANA we have used that approach for the formats guidelines. Even the new chemistry code is going to have a supplemental section that has examples. And so using the GTM as a supplement and as guidelines that have more examples, that's what people, I think, really want to see, especially for things that are not represented fully in the GTM, like geometry and some of the other higher level things. But really, the rules for using UEB for technical materials should be in the rule book, and they should be the things that people can follow. If they want to look at examples, then that's what the GTM can be.
Thank you. Judy?
I have a microphone. I think there might be more instances in the technical materials where there might be more than one way to do things. But I think we need to be careful saying to people, oh, it's okay, you know, as long as it back translates correctly. I personally don't like the way mustard is written. So can I start putting a U in it whenever I feel like? I mean, it'll back translate correctly, and I know that. But people don't know what will back translate correctly. And I really think that this is a dangerous road to start down. Okay.
Thank you. I heard you, James. Can I go to Leona and Australia first? So Leona first and then Australia, sorry.
Oh, where's Leona?
Thank you.
Sorry. I was agreeing with what people were saying about the division between the rules and the examples. I also, as someone who has previously worked a lot on the distribution of the rule book and the rule book in terms of publishing it, just wanted to flag the amount of work that is involved in producing those documents each time that they're released. So don't promise to release things every year unless you've got someone amazing who's able to do that for you, and it won't be me. just a word of warning.
Thank you, I appreciate that. Australia, it was Geordie who said, but I don't know if it was Geordie who wanted to speak.
Oh, it's a message from Kathy. So
thank
she
you,
was just contributing that she'd like to see the GTM as a separate booklet. I liked Jodie's, this is her opinion, is that FM's got a good suggestion about the supplement. And then Kathy's got another comment. This is something that was applied with the Australian formatting guidelines. It's actually the Australian rules and guidelines for Braille formatting. It used the approach where non-negotiable rules were clearly differentiated from what can be considered guidelines. And she just suggested that a similar approach could be adopted when updating the guidelines for technical materials, so there is clarity between non-negotiable rules and then others which may be considered guidelines. I've used those guidelines myself, and I found it quite easy to follow. Actually, in our Braille unit, we developed in-house procedures, and we, you know, the ones that were non-negotiable, we had to adopt, and then there was a bit of leeway about how, you know, we wanted to do some other things with our formatting. So, yeah, that worked quite well. And she can't see officially documented that shape indicator sets grade one mode needs updating. And the enclosure thing, there's a section here. What James was saying, I just don't understand it. I'll have to look into it more. It's not clear enough, I guess, so it does need updating. It says each composite symbol indicator will need a grade one symbol indicator unless the whole expression isn't already in grade one mode. So that kind of makes me think it's not automatically put into grade one mode if you're needing to add all these extra grade one symbol indicators. I don't know.
Thank you. We'll,
that for later.
I think that's a piece of work that I need a rule book in front of me to look at. But thank you, Jodie, and thank you, Kathy, for the comments. I'm very appreciative of those. James Bowden.
Thank you. I would agree as well. I like Section 11 to have the rules which govern the use of the various symbols required for technical material. And I would suggest that's where the grade one indicator discussion should go as well, the preferred way to do it. We've talked about transcribers and document authors needing those. Software manufacturers also need a singular way to produce stuff. Software programmers don't like, well, you could do it this way, or you could do it that way, or maybe if it happens, and then you might have to do that. That's no good for a programmer, no good for a computer at all. It may be fine for a student and a human who's got intelligence, but machines really don't at the present time, and they need a rule. And I absolutely agree to keep GTM a separate book for two reasons. First of all, it would bloat the size of the rules of Unified English Braille if it were combined. And
many transcribers who don't do technical subjects would find the whole of that part completely useless and a waste of paper.
Okay.
And the second reason, of course, is the plenty more examples.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, James. Frances Mary.
Sorry. Hopefully I didn't do that. The only other thing I would say about the math thing and having multiple ways of doing things, the United States is very test happy, and we require by federal law a number of standardized tests for our students to take at different grades. And some states, because of course we're not United States, some states have rules even that if children don't pass the standardized tests, they're not allowed to go on to the next grade and other things. And so the consistency issue is one that is talked about a lot from teachers, because they want to know what is the child going to see on the standardized test so that they're not put at a disadvantage when they get the test and they see something in a form that they don't understand. And when we're little children, I mean, older kids, you know, may be able to figure out, but, you know, third grader may not.
Golden. Thank you. Jen Golden, yep.
Along those lines too, as someone who's taken the UEB technical certification, when you're doing a test and you don't, it's like, well, you could do it this way, this is sort of the preferred way, and it's a very detail-oriented test and you need to get 90% to pass. I mean, this is a more niche need, right? But the people that are getting the certifications are the ones that are going to be transcribing and proofreading and, you know, in some cases maybe teaching it. So just kind of a vote for some clarification. And then I would just say, and I'm sure that everyone is, you know, people are probably already thinking about this, but I understand we have a lot of work to do and it doesn't happen overnight, but the longer it takes us, people are just going to come up with their own thing. And it's going to be harder when we come along and say, okay, we got it figured out. And they're like, yeah, but we've been doing this for 5 years or 10 years.
Yeah. Thank you. We have about 10 minutes of this session left, and I don't want to finish late because Judy's already said we're not going to finish late. The one thing that was left on my thing that I wanted to just sort of briefly touch on, I don't think we really need to spend too much time on it, so it's a good thing to round off on, is this issue of word lists. We have a charge to expand Appendix 2 to include more words. There's been a lot of work done on that, and one of the things that I'm hoping to do quite urgently off the back of this General Assembly is to try and consolidate that and work out where we are and where we need to go next with that. But that's we need to create a word list. I think there are two questions that I have. It's been suggested that the word list be published as a separate document rather than expanding Appendix 2, that we just publish a word list as a reference document, as a supplementary document. So I'd be interested in people's thoughts on that. And I'd also be interested in people's thoughts on where do we draw the line in terms of what words do we include and what words do we not include. You know, I mean, you could have a word list of 10,000 words if you wanted, but I don't think anybody wants that. So where do we draw the line? I'll throw it open for comment there. Bowden UK, thank you.
The precedent has already been set about word lists from our previous publications, both English Braille American edition and British Braille had word lists, and I'm going to suggest that the Rules of Unified English Braille should have a similar list as the previous publications. Starter for 10.
Okay, any other thoughts? Blimey. DeAndrea, hello.
Nobody wants to bring up the word beret. We've had discussions over the years about, you know, we used to call it the problem word list, and I think finally we came up, I think maybe Kathy Reeson actually came up with the term disputed word list. That words that which may be brailled differently in different countries. I know James has brought a list of place names in the UK which bear no resemblance to how they're pronounced, for example. And so there are, I think, words that are that are disputed, some of which because of what Bill mentioned earlier about contraction rules and things. And I just wanted to make that the one point. I know that, Matthew, you mentioned that the CMC had talked about Engelbretson's and Simon Fischerbaum's work. It wasn't about pronunciation. It wasn't about syllable breaking. It was about meaning morphemes. It was about pieces of meaningful words, not about syllable breaks. And so I think some of the disputed words or words that might be on a word list where people don't know how to, I mean, look how long we talked about Beethoven, for example. or don't look at how long we talked about Beethoven. But the I think some of the words that have kind of bubbled up on various lists over the years are because of lack of clarity as far as which rule applies in which case. And some of those we just may need to make a sweeping decision about and just say, you know, anything that's this is now, this is how it's contracted, rather than going through 30 disputed words, you know, one by one and wrangling about them for months. So I just want to, I mean, people aren't sure what we're referring to when we talk about the word list, but we know that some of the lists that have been shared by the US and the UK are words where there wasn't international agreement as far as how they should be contracted.
Thank you. Doolin.
Six. Yeah. Hi, Matthew. I was just thinking that, you know, the BE contraction, that's always a tricky one, and I was wondering if there might be some thoughts about, you know, how to defining the syllable break. Where would you go for that? It came up, I was transcribing beryllium, but Duxbury did it as beryllium, you know, with the ER. But, and I looked up, I don't know, some online dictionary and found that BE was the first syllable. So I contracted it that way, but the proofreader wasn't too happy because he'd always seen the ER contraction used. Yeah, it was just a question about the dictionary that you might use or how you would determine the syllables. I say beryllium, but some people say beryllium.
Well, it's interesting because I would always expect it to be the ER sign in beryllium.
Because there was a discussion on the CMC and it was agreed that BE was correct, but that's why I don't think the BE contraction's a very popular one.
I mean, I'm sure that BE is correct, in fact, because it follows all the rules, but
it follows the syllable break, yeah.
Yeah,
and the way
never
I say
expect,
it.
Never expect it there.
Hmm.
It depends on what dictionary.
So maybe you need to consider the dictionary.
Do we need to standardize the dictionary that we use? Yeah. Do we have any final comments? We've got about 2 minutes left. Any final comments on this? Okay.
Yeah, there is.
I'll take it then. Yeah, James Bowden. Yeah.
I just would like to find out.
Oh, okay. We'll take.
Oh,
Ivan.
Sorry. Excuse me. There was someone else.
I'll take. Can I take James first, and then I will take Ivan because you've got a microphone, and then we'll call it a day there.
Ivan has the microphone. I have to take it.
Oh, I see. I do apologise.
That's all right. I'm there.
Well, Amanda's here now. I'm sorry, Amanda. I hadn't registered that.
Just one more comment about the usefulness of a word list. I have heard transcribers like it because they can see if they're doing it right. So it's not just about exception words, it's also about just to make sure the transcribers get it right. Now, I know we've also got the wonderful work of the, what is it, the Braille Enthusiasts Dictionary. That's huge. But I will again say our previous publications did have lots of example words, and I advocate, and I would actually put a motion that we would have a similar word list, a similar in size to the previous publications in the Rules of Unified English Braille.
Thanks, James. We are about to finish. I'll take Ivan's comment because he asked for the floor, and then we'll leave it there, I think. And just, thanks, Amanda, for running around so much.
Thank you. Just for out of curiosity, I just would like to find out how did you sort it out, this hard decision on where to decide if one word was accepted or not in this last decision. Is it a syllable? Is it a pronunciation? Is it a country style of pronouncing it? Something like that. I was very curious to know if it would be allowed to ask this question, of course.
Yeah. I mean, it's essentially by committee, the Code Maintenance Committee, if there was a tricky word, the Code Maintenance Committee would have a discussion and try to rationalise a particular response and then would take a vote on it. And it would be the Code Maintenance Committee which has one representative per country, and that's how those decisions are reached. And they sometimes take quite a long time to reach. Okay. Okay, we're up on time. Look, thank you, everybody. You never quite know how a discussion is going to go until you start it. And I can't say as it went quite as I expected it to go, but it was nonetheless extremely useful. So thank you to everybody for being so engaged in the discussion and for your time. I will end it there. I will pass it back to Judy in case there are any final remarks. Okay. I've been asked by the president to say, no, there are no final remarks. This session is adjourned until 8:30 tomorrow morning. We'll see you back here somewhere between 6:45 and 7 this evening for the dinner. Thank you.